Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello and welcome to The Tillage Podcast, coming to you from IFJ HQ in the Irish Farm Centre. I'm Siobhan Walsh and I'm joined by Andy Doyle and Pat O'Toole. It's Thursday morning, we have the paper in front of us and it's bursting with news. On the tillage front, we have the preliminary crop area figures from the department, an update on nitrates. Andy is reporting on unprecedented times in grain markets, and of course there's news from the World Potato Congress. That's all coming up, but as usual, we'll start with our roundup from the fields. So I suppose weather has been a bit kinder this week and it looks good for the weekend. Andy, you've been in the RDS for the week, but what are you hearing on the ground?
Well, look, generally speaking, things are good, Siobhan. People are generally happy. I haven't been in fields. I must admit I've been wrapped up in Dublin for most of the past week. It's nice to see wheat heading out, and it's now kind of headed almost all over the country. And we won't be long until the spring barley will be doing the same. So, and generally, no major problems, but probably one exception to that. BYDV is becoming evident, and we're hearing about it all over the country.
Absolutely, yeah. I think BYDV, I was at a Laois IFA grain meeting on Monday night, and BYDV was one of the topics of the night. And I think anyone, whether they're tillage or not, if they look out in the fields, they'll see those yellow flecks across fields. Pat, what are things like down in Wexford?
Mixed. A lot of barley still looks very good, but there are some fields. I have one field that's pretty bad. The question is whether there's going to be any yield effect from what visually it looks concerning from the road. Experience in the last few years has been there's been very little yield effect. There's a lot of tillers there, there's a lot of plants there, so there's still optimism that the effect of BYDV will be minimal on yield. But having said that, there are some very badly affected patches in fields here and there.
Yeah, what we're seeing in the fields like is single leaves, with, you know, basically with a yellow top or a whole single yellow leaf, and it's something that we've seen, you know, a lot in spring barley over recent years. But it's nothing like what we saw in winter barley this year. Like in winter barley we saw the very visual circles in the field, dwarf crops. Andy, like we don't know what yield effect it has had in recent years, but as Pat said, we think it's very little. What do you think?
I'm of that view as well, Siobhan. I think if we go back to the times when we had, I'm going to use the phrase real BYDV, and I don't say that flippantly, but you know when you have it. I mean, it's called yellow because it's not pale leaf, it's a half yellow leaf, and it's every leaf on the same plant. And basically, being a virus, it's quite like any of us getting the flu. If somebody has a flu, you might see the symptom of a runny nose, or you could see red eyes or something else. But they feel much different to just those symptoms because they have aching bones, they may have difficulty breathing. So viruses go through everything, and the more severe the virus, the bigger the yield effect. And really, we don't really know what specific viruses we're having in fields with some of these symptoms. And we're probably lucky at this point in time that we have a lot of that work actually going on in Chagas to try and differentiate what specific viruses are causing what symptoms and what aphids are carrying what viruses. And, you know, they may even be able to pick up a little bit on the impact of when an infection would come in. Because, you know, my life in cereals would always have told me that the area that's going to be worst affected with BYDV were the crops that emerged late when aphids were gone on the wing, and areas in a field where establishment was poor, that could be patches or a whole crop, where you got green plants in a brown surround. And for an aphid on the wing, I've always been of a view that must shine up as a bright yellow, and bright yellow attracts insects, because those patches, those stitched in patches in winter crops, they've always been a haven for BYDV.
Yeah, and of course, like, a lot of crops were sown in March and people didn't spray, you know, which is the right, that's the advice that's there. It was the right thing to do, but I suppose we had no severe frosts over winter, and there was probably a carryover of a lot of aphids over winter.
Siobhan, I might just add one other thing to that, and that is if we go back far enough in the early days of virus research in Oak Park, you know, we had a number of years of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 applications of insecticide when they were totally effective early in the springtime on crops, to see at what stage could you most effectively stop virus, and how often would you need to spray to stop virus. And at the end of the day, 5 insecticides still had quite a number of yellow leaves. 1 insecticide tended in the main to produce the same yield as all the others. And that's where the advice have come from, that sometimes we can't stop these symptoms, but for whatever reason or reasons, they may be of no significance other than aesthetically to the crop.
Yeah. Look, things are busy in the fields otherwise. I know, like, heads are coming out on winter wheat, so tea trees are going out and will be going out over the next few days. You know, beans are flowering, huge variation in beans, you know, whether early or late sown. Someone even said to me yesterday, they're at the stage where there's a fungicide going out on spring rape, so there's lots to be done out there. I think, look, we'll move on. And there was really positive news in the past week. We spoke about it on the podcast last week. We knew the tillage areas were coming out. I don't think we were too far off, Andy, in our estimates. But look, positive news. Tillage area has increased by 6.1% and nearly 20,000 hectares this year. And on the flip side of that, the vegetable area has decreased by 12%, which is something that we shouldn't forget. I suppose I might run through some of the figures just to give people an idea. Sorry, you might hear my laptop now shaking around. So what do we have? So total barley area is at 190,000. So winter barley area went up about 6,000. Spring barley area only went up by 600. But I suppose there was a prediction that spring barley area would go down, but the tillage incentive scheme probably avoided that scenario. Winter wheat saw an increase of about 4,000, so 4,268 hectares. The oats area actually went down. The total oats area went down by almost 200 hectares. And then rye saw a massive increase. So rye increased by 1,400 hectares. So total cereal area came up by 12,943 hectares. And then on the rape side, no surprise, price went up. We saw an increase from 11,200 hectares to 15,770 hectares. Beans area, which is something that we spoke about. Where am I gone on beans? So they went from spring beans 8,600 to 9,273. Maize saw an increase of about 1,300 hectares. Beet an increase of 250, and then potatoes actually came down. So potato area came down, and it came down in the main crop area, which is worrying, by 380 hectares. So a total increase then on other crops of 6,800. So we're nearly at the 20,000 increase. So what do you think, lads, or what's your opinion on it?
Well, Siobhan, just some comments, and they were probably related to the comments that we made last week, and that is that there was an expectation that winter wheat would be up. And if winter wheat was going to be up predominantly because of home-safe seed, and that's difficult to track, and that's why it couldn't be catered for in previous estimates. If winter wheat was going to be up, then probably winter barley was going to be up as well, and it was. The spring barley comment, I would say, is 100% correct, Siobhan. You know, we can't plant two crops in the 1 acre. So if something if winter crops were up, they were coming out of land that had been in spring barley, or at least some of it had, therefore, you know, that swing had to happen. And certainly the incentive scheme was important. I think the one figure in there that's always going to be subject to question is potatoes, because potatoes is one that. There's always uncertainty as to what the acreage is, and I'm probably always more guided by the grower's opinion of acreage than the actual figure, because there's bound to be an amount of potato area that's not in the system, possibly even individual growers that don't have BPS applications. But this potato one has come up almost every year in recent years, and it's turned out to end up at a different number to the number that we talked about.
Yeah.
But the fodder as well, Siobhan, the beet and the may is, you know, it's not really a surprise to us to see that. Because, you know, if people are awake at all in terms of the risks to the sector as a whole, they do have to be moving to protect their overall fodder supply. So that's happening. That has happened to some degree, thankfully. I think that's kind of nearly all the big comment. But the 6% increase in area is certainly worthwhile. The big question now is how much of that might be maintained or sustained into the future, and will we see policy to help keep some of that area there in time?
Yeah, absolutely. Is some of that area going to go back into grass again this year? And I suppose, Pat, coming to you on it, like, you know, there was an increase in winter crop area already, so, you know, we were probably expecting an increase in tillage area, but certainly not to the same extent. So did the minister's tillage incentive scheme work?
It seems to have had an effect, and also I think optimism around pricing as the spring progressed, it became more and more obvious that the markets had reacted very quickly to the increase in input prices and the increase in milk price. I suppose one area of concern, and one area that the department will be looking at, I think, is proteins, because there is an obvious need now for proteins to be grown in Europe if food security is an issue. And the commissioner who was with us this week said food security is now front and centre in the European Commission's thinking. We're still way behind there, and small progress when you consider the extent of the supports that's going to be there, with a minimum of 300 euros a hectare in protein aid. Beans were an attractive option, especially as a break crop, but the increase in bean acreage is still very slow.
Yeah, it's slow, and I suppose there was a worry it wouldn't make the 10,000. So that 300, the minimum of 300, definitely helped. Very concerningly, veg area decreased. And I suppose we've talked about it on the podcast before. You know, veg farmers said this year they're leaving the sector. A lot of them, you know, I suppose we wondered would they really, and the figures show it there now. So 880 hectares down. So it's, you know, it's 6,600 hectares of veg in this country. I mean, you know, that's really concerning.
Farmers had very little choice but to sit and wait for a price increase, because they're working 6 to 9 months ahead. And I suppose it's a damning indictment of our food systems. And we hear a lot about Food Vision 2030 and food systems. The reality is that the sector that is most dependent on the Irish consumer and the Irish retailer is the vegetable sector. The sector with the most direct chain straight through to the consumer, through the retailer, is the Irish vegetable sector and the fruit sector. And the one that is suffering the most at the moment is the Irish fruit and vegetable sector. Our dairy and beef sectors, which have to export 90% of their produce, have seen price respond quickly. Double-digit increases for fruit and vegetables is all that's being asked of retailers at the moment, and it's not happening. So I think I'm not quite sure how this plays out, but there's going to be serious long-term consequences because of the scale of investment involved and the labour requirements on a vegetable farm. if you lose a vegetable farm, you lose it forever, I think. And we're going to regret what's happening at the moment. And I think the retailers will regret it. But something needs to change very, very quickly.
Yeah, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Patton. We can't forget here as well that there's a massive amount of jobs in the vegetable sector, and those jobs are going with these farms. To put things into perspective, like, I'm just looking through the figures, and, you know, the swedes area is down 50 hectares. The broccoli area is down 120 hectares. So, like, we know that these are individual farmers leaving the sector, and there's really nothing being done about it, Andy. There was that support package, but it's not enough.
Yeah, look, we saw a panel of people being assembled to look at fodder and food. Like, there seems to be no emphasis at all on food and where that's coming from. And, you know, you stand back from it and you see all the consumer research saying that consumers are most concerned about the provenance of product that is closest to their mouths. So, you know, if they want, they're concerned about the provenance of beef because they're eating it. But the veg that they have at least once, or maybe in some instances twice a day, nobody seems to be paying any major attention to where it's coming from. Mm. And as Pat rightly said, and it was referred to in a recent meeting that I attended, the loss of intellectual property that goes out the gate every time we lose a farmer that had so much experience and skills to do, I won't say beat nature, but to work with nature in order to deliver produce week after week, day after day, and then year after year. Once that's gone, it's gone. You can't replace that instantly.
Yeah. Look, I think we could stay talking on this topic for a long time, but we better move on in the interest of time. So, Andy, the World Potato Congress was on this week, and you've been there all week. Tell us what's been going on.
Well, yes, Siobhan, look, a World Congress for anything is a big deal. So we might expect to host a Beef World Congress or maybe a Dairy World Congress because we're significant. We're less significant in the potato world currently, but of course Ireland was hugely significant in the potato world and indeed in world history because of what happened, the famine. And when you frequently hear the comments made about the 5 million population in Ireland today with 80 million Irish diaspora, you know, realistically, and maybe unfortunately, but they would not be there were it not for the famine. Or most of them would not have been there, and the footprint would not have been there were it not for the famine. So it has cast a long shadow. So the Congress then was about kind of getting people of the potato world together to think, talk and meet about things that matter in the short term and in the long term. And basically, potatoes are the fourth most important foodstuff in the world. And they're generally regarded as one of the easiest carbohydrates to grow for very many regions of the world. And that's blight, etc., excluded in that comment, because they have to be managed. But it's interesting still, you know, there were people showing me photographs of new varieties that have been bred and they were not getting late blight. Now, I hope that was done with multi-gene technology rather than single-gene technology, but we know that this is now possible and it can fairly fundamentally change things. We also know that the area of potatoes in the world is decreasing, but the production of potatoes is arguably increasing. We might also know that the vast majority of potatoes in the world are still grown by people with probably a lot less than a half an acre, a few square metres, right up to the guys with 30,000-40,000 acres of spuds, and they were there as well at the Congress. So it was terrific to get all of that spread of people in the same room at the same time. You know, I was at a talk on Wednesday morning, and we were talking about potato storage and about filling a 4,500-ton potato store in 3 days. With one's own harvesting equipment. You know, it's scale means different things to different people, and we can't avoid that. But it was a feather in the cap of the Irish potato industry. The Irish Potato Federation organised to get the thing to get the gig into the country. And when you have so many people from all over the world, from literally every corner of the world, assembled there, and some of them in their national uniforms, it was a fantastic event to be just to be part of. So it was well done to all concerned.
Absolutely. And it was great to see the spotlight on potatoes as well, and the industry in the national media. It was on the 6-1 News and it was all over the paper. So good to see. And I suppose with the Congress came a lot of dignitaries, and Pat, the Commissioner, came, and you were here. The Commissioner came to the Farm Centre and met the IFA on Monday, wasn't it?
That's right. It was his first port of call. When he landed in Dublin Airport, he came to the Farm Centre before going over to open the potato conference. So I suppose he sat down with the IFA Council and he made a presentation that lasted about 20 minutes, and then there was an exchange of questions and answers that went on for a further 40 minutes. Mm. From the tillage point of view, a couple of things he said that were of interest. He talked about how the Commission is concerned about how Ukraine's grain is going to be got out of the country, and that they're actively looking at new routes because of the destruction of ports in the Black Sea. And he said looking for alternative corridors, both for his own native Poland and for Romania, which are bordering Ukraine. But in terms of policy, he said that the Commission is already agreeing that crop rotation and the three-crop rule, as we know it in this country, which has been suspended for this year, is likely to be suspended next year in the first year of the new CAP. He said, my intention is to suspend the crop rotation. And later on, he said, I'm ready to consider the temporary suspension of this proposal. So I think it's about maximising flexibility for farmers to grow the most crop they can, with a view to replacing the lost crop from Russia and Ukraine. He did make the point that Europe will not suffer from a food shortage. If there's a global food shortage, it's Africa which is most likely to suffer, but that Europe has a responsibility to minimise that probability. And I think we can all sign up for that. And of course, the potato, as an alternative to grain produced, whether it's pasta or couscous or spaghetti or bread, the potato can offer an alternative. It may be very important in the next few years, because there's no sign that this conflict is coming to any kind of early resolution.
Yeah, I suppose on those things that the minister said, like, I suppose the one that's, you know, really affecting Irish farmers there is that the derogation from the true crop rule, or the crop diversification requirement. Andy, like, I'd say you have a few thoughts on this. I know at the time when it came out, like, people were concerned, and, you know, they were worried maybe that they wouldn't be able to sow the crop that was going to give them the most money. But I think farmers, you know, it's helped to improve the tillage system.
Yeah, Siobhan, there's been a number of obligatory demands of Europe on our farming systems, which would have been met strongly, adversely, that is, by farmers. But I think the vast majority of farmers now would recognise that rotation brings certain advantages, as well as the whole mechanisation and workload part of the deal. You know, it does bring benefits across the board. And I think people would be kind of fairly slow to go away from rotation, particularly when we look at next year and we're going to have a new protein scheme coming in, protein aid scheme, and higher rates of support there. And with nitrogen prices, fertiliser prices, but particularly nitrogen prices, like, that's probably not going to go away completely in the short term either. Mm. I think that people would be very unwise to just abandon rotation in favour of chasing a fast buck in one other crop. And, you know, I think the one good thing that I would have seen from the current set of disruptions, probably is the best way to say it, is the number of people who decided at farm level to follow the money and go for the crop where the money was. And in springtime, people chased grain as where they thought the money was, but grain price is always much more fickle than some others. And we'll talk about it later, but grain price today is not where it was at the start of the spring, or even where it was mid-spring when it really went mad altogether. Yeah. We're in a different place now, and I think that's something that people have to be conscious of going forward.
Yeah, I think the tree crop rule, you know, it's really helped people to appreciate rotation, I suppose, and it's put more of a focus on it. And we're probably in a different stage as well than, was it 2015 when the crop diversification requirement came in, I think. You know, we probably have more options there for farmers as well. Like, you know, we have the Here Oilseed Rape, and we have the gluten-free oats, and we have a lot more options of premium crops to put into that crop rotation. Andy, you mentioned grain markets, and we'll come to you on grain markets and where price is in a minute, but I suppose something that's been coming up a lot when we talk to farmers and at that Leash IFA grain meeting on Monday night, it came up again. I suppose people are asking Pat about the fixed milk price, and you know, I suppose I'll let you go into it because it's a complicated issue, but I suppose they're looking at, they've sold grain and these farmers have sold milk, and what's the difference?
Before I do, I just, so it's what, Thursday morning, 2nd of June, I've just got my notification from the department and I opened it.
Oh.
So the strong corporation measure, I've got my notification. So people check your...
Oh, very good.
Check agfood.ie and make sure that you're in if you've applied. So in terms of the fixed milk price scheme, it's affecting a minority of farmers, of dairy farmers, but it's affecting them, some of them extremely badly. Glanbia were the pardon me, were the first co-op to introduce a fixed milk price scheme, and they were one of the most exposed. Estimates vary as to how much of their milk is tied up in fixed milk price schemes, but somewhere between 15% and 25%. Now you've got to remember, Glanbia are on 3 billion litres, so you're talking telephone numbers. 15% is 450 million litres of milk fixed at 31 cent, most of it. Farmers typically would have fixed a certain amount each year, and it lasts 2 or 3 years. The big problem a lot of farmers have is that typically you tendered for twice what you wanted because the schemes were oversubscribed. So if a farmer wanted 100,000 litres, he would apply for 200,000 litres. Last year, in the final scheme, farmers got everything they asked for. So that meant a lot of farmers got twice what they wanted, and that was illegal at the time, a nuisance. But now, as markets have turned, that 31 cent a litre, prices are now north of 45 cent a litre, and production costs are at 40 cent a litre, which means you're losing 9 cents a litre on every litre you produce. And that's a real problem. So different co-ops have taken different alleviation measures. Depending on their level of exposure, it's easier for some than others. We now have discovered in this week's paper, it's emerged that Arrivo have been supporting the co-ops to take measures to support farmers. There's about 4 million euros, or sorry, not Arrivo, Ornua have put about 4 million of their funds into the co-ops to help farmers. I've talked to farmers who have 85, 90% of their milk fixed. They're in real trouble. They can't sustain. And the solutions that have been offered, if we take Glanbia's solution, some farmers have signed up for it where they will get a higher price this year, and they get over 40 cent a litre, but they have to agree to accept 38 cent a litre for the same portion of milk for the next 2 years.
Okay.
That now looks like a bad price because markets seem to be staying high, fertiliser prices starting to come back. But there are as many reasons to believe we're in a period of very high prices as there are to believe there will be a return to what we might have previously called normality. So farmers are reducing their exposure to loss this year, but increasing their potential exposure to loss in 2023 and 2024.
It's basically going to average out, Pat. Like, it kind of sounds a bit like that.
Well, the reality is, look, at the moment, farmers, I talked to one farmer yesterday, and he got over 60 cent a litre in his milk check because he's high solids.
Okay.
And when you're getting 60 cent for some of your milk and 30 cent for other of your milk, you might say, okay, it depends on the proportion of milk you fixed. If 2/3 of your milk is only getting 31 cent and the rest of it's getting 60 cent, your production costs are at 40 cent and you have high repayments because you're a greenfield or an expanding farmer and you've invested, you're in trouble. That's the reality.
Yeah. So there's serious consequences out there. But
the parallels for grain, grain farmers believe that one of the reasons Glanbia and Dairy Gold, in particular, Dairy Gold have made almost no moves, and they are two very big buyers of grain. They sell grain forward and have been in fairness, very progressive about offering farmers opportunities to take good prices from the marketplace. And then you've got Boort Malt, who have been offering farmers to fix their grain price. And some farmers believe that the knock-on consequences of making significant gestures to dairy farmers for Glanbia and Derrygold would be that they would then have to address grain farmers who sold forward and are facing similar squeezes where the costs have risen exponentially since the price was fixed and are facing almost certain loss. With the yield variation, we're now reasonably confident we'll get a good harvest. But if you got a 2018, if you got bad yields, and if you added in a bad price, you're in a disaster. So tillage farmers are concerned. I myself have fixed 40% of my malting barley forward. I wrote about that in the Long Read there 2 weeks ago. And that's fixed at 240 and 260, an average of 250 euros. It was a good price at the time. It was a record price. But now the price for malting barley is north of 400, and it looks like a terrible price. But my problems are minimal compared to... I'm exposed to lose a few thousand. I probably lost as much because I didn't buy fertiliser last September. The lessons to be learned going forward long term, I think, are that if you're selling, cattle farmers would always have said you must buy the day you sell if you're a finisher. You replace the stock you've sold, because when prices are high, you buy high, sell high. When they're low, you buy low, sell low. I think if you're selling grain, you need to buy inputs. So you need to go out and buy the fertiliser at a price which relates to the grain price you're selling at, and that will insulate you. If you gamble, you could lose.
Yeah. And look, at the meeting the other night, I think farmers, you know, I suppose disappointed now that they sold at those prices of 250 and 270, and now they see them go higher. But, you know, happy with their decision at the time. And I think, you know, the tillage farmers the other night at the meeting, you know, they said, right, we sold at a price we were happy with at the time, and we move on now. And that's very important, Andy, isn't it, that we keep these structures in place?
Yes, Siobhan, in my book it's very important. You know, people have been selling forward for a long time now. Not that many people, but certainly some people have. And yes, there will always be scenarios where there will be winners and losers. But the people who sell forward on a consistent annual basis, they sell because they're protecting some of their investment on the one hand. They're also selling because there's a market there on that day. Somebody wants it that day. Sometimes that's that offer of price will be above the rate for the day. Sometimes it will only equal the rate for the day. But it's a real option. And I think the one thing that farmers kind of never take into consideration is that if we turn around next harvest and have to buy a 2.2 or 2.3 million ton harvest, the risk you can afford to take with that 2.3 million tons as a buyer at almost double last year's price is zero. You cannot take risk. You've got to find cover somewhere in the system to be able to cope with it. And therefore, if we had 20%, 30%, 40% of our grain sold forward, it actually opens the door for the potential of slightly stronger green prices at harvest in certain years. Not every year, is fair to say. But if we didn't have that forward option, I think we would be in a lesser place in terms of the overall market. And I also know that people who might have lost a little in the past because they sold early, as was the case this year, those same people get a phone call at some point in the future when prices are low, but for some reason they jump on a day saying, would you take a bit of this price today? And generally they do. So the trade always tries to look after the people who feed the trade. And the other thing I think, and this is an important one that we have to remember, my biggest fear at this point in time, as a commentator in the industry, is that we've had a lot of business taking place over the past 4 or 5 months, where people who are using 1,000, 10,000 tonnes per week, they have to access feed, they have to know where their feed's coming from. The only thing they've been able to buy is imported, and in the main, the best value on the import market is maize. So if enough of imported product is bought, stand back and think about it, nobody will want the Irish product. And that is the worst of all worlds that we have to be careful of. When the market is mature, we have to be prepared to mature a little with it. We shouldn't be selling 70% forward. You know, some people might be 20%, some people might be 10%, and you shouldn't go selling a big lump on any one day. That's just a basic of the market. The simple sum say, no more than 50% up to 2 weeks of harvest when you know what's in the field. Don't sell too much more then either, because you still haven't got it until it's actually in the trailer or in the store. Because so many things can happen that leave it wrong. And of course, the big risk in Ireland for forward selling, as we learned from 2012, is the inability to deliver the quality that we signed up to.
Yeah. And Andy, look, you mentioned you know, where grain prices are, and in the paper this week you're looking back over where they've been in the year. So I suppose, can you, where are they this week, and tell us a bit about what you have in the paper this week as well?
Well, look, at what I have on the paper is now different to what I'm going to say now, Siobhan, because that's what's happening.
It's
in
the nature of it.
It can occur both ways. Look, at the futures markets are, in a sense, what we give an awful lot of credence to and have given for the past number of months. Futures markets for December wheat hit a top end of about 438 a tonne. At peak. I can't remember just when exactly that was, but that was the highest kind of individual price that I can remember seeing on the screens. Last night, that same price closed at 375. Tuesday night, it had closed at 385. So in the paper this week, I think I was referring to a drop of 50 euro. On this podcast, I'm saying that prices are now down 60 euro from peak. And that is the vulnerability of the grain market. That's driven by talk of finding ways to get grain out of the Ukraine, which means negotiating a sea corridor. That may or may not happen. You know, we just don't know whether that will happen or not. But based on the optimism that it will, prices will fall. I am actually expecting prices to go back up again today for other technical reasons, more real and more genuine reasons in the market. You mentioned earlier about the commissioner saying about getting grain out of the Ukraine. The biggest problem, I think, in the Ukraine at the moment, because I spoke to a number of Ukrainian people at the Potato Congress, is that there's about 26 million tons of grain in store. Grains, which is both maize, wheat, barley and oilseeds, which should be gone to a market somewhere. And that's now in the way of the coming harvest. And that's the big risk, that if that stays there, there's not enough storage capacity to hold whatever quantity will be produced in the harvest. And that's where the real big risk begins to magnify. And it's interesting, the guy was saying, look, this is not a one-year thing. This is probably ultimately going to leave a shadow of about 4 years' duration in an awful lot of world markets. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of us would agree with that. And at the Pareto conference, just by way of comment, the Director General of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the WHO came over to speak to the conference. And I know that he's been in Ireland all week visiting other people, dignitaries, research institutions, etc. So, you know, everybody is looking at access to food, the production and access to food, as being more important than has been the case for the last number of decades at this point.
Yeah. So, look, I suppose people will be keeping a keen eye on markets over the next week, and we'll see how they progress. I don't actually have the FOB Crail in front of me this week, so apologies, but we'll have it next week and have the average as well.
Siobhan, I might just say one thing just before I leave prices, and that is that, you know, last week and the week before, we began to see a disassociation between physical price offers and forward prices, because the forward prices were gone so far ahead of where the feed market was operating that it just did not make sense. That's arguably still the case. Maize this week was, I think, about 3.6, I can't remember whether it was 3.65 or 3.75 a tonne imported November. Like, that's the price against which we have to be able to sell barley, maybe not wheat, but certainly barley come harvest. And that's influencing the offers that are there for barley. So, you know, you have barley today, generally the quotes that were there 2 days ago, they might not be there today, kind of between 370 and 380. Wheat 380, 385. They were the prices earlier in the week. They're physical, they won't move around nearly as much as the futures do, so maybe they're still there. But it's a long way off what we thought the peak was.
Okay. Yeah, and you gave me a breeder there to get the price, Andy. So the Fab Cradle for Sebastian, now not Planet, was at 4.68 last night, so it's down a bit on last week. We need to move on time. So weather, Andy, where are we at?
Generally speaking, things looking reasonably well for the coming week. Siobhan, lots of areas with maybe five zeros on the chart, some of them with maybe only three. Rain certainly forecast for a lot of areas today, because of those big showers that are going around, but predominantly in the west, southwest, midlands and northwest. So, you know, it's predominantly going to be the west coast. After that, we have a good number of zeros. We have wind speeds that are, with the exception of today and maybe parts of tomorrow, generally well within the sprayer operator range, or safe sprayer operator range. And temperatures, again, are back up, kind of 16s. Just the forecast this morning saying 60 and up to 20. So good growth conditions. We're glad of the kind of slightly cooler conditions for the last few weeks during some of the stem extension in crops, just to slow them down a little bit, help them to grow that little bit hardier. So it looks like it's going to be a week that we can get work done in.
Absolutely. Right. Great. Thanks a million, Andy. And thank you, Pat. And apologies about the noise. We're up in the office today, so I suppose that background noise shows that we occasionally come to Bluewell. But look, maybe by the time this is edited, Jerome and Philip will have got it out, but I think there's a lot of noise there. So anyway, apologies for that. And thanks for joining us. So stay safe for the rest of the week and keep the tillage fact flying.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.